Dan Barish, the Jewish liberal from Cleveland.
And this is Matt Shepard, the Mormon conservative from Seattle.
And we are the common ground.
So we're continuing the saga of the epic racial saga that we started here.
Yes.
Anyway, did you have some things you want to start out on, Dan?
Or yes, this thing's been, you know, marinating in my mind, and of course, various controversies have continued no matter what we did or didn't do, because of course they do. The life continues on. No new outrages have been committed that have struck up nearly the level of protest of Eric Garner or Ferguson or Tamir Rice, but it's just getting reinforced for me over and over and over that the experience of the world is quite simply different if you're a black person in America. It just is. So as these thoughts have marinated for me, I think one thing that's big is, you know, I've always been bothered in this country that a state of race relations is so bad that most white people, I think, are afraid to have an earnest conversation with most black people about race. I don't know how it feels for black people. I know that white people are sometimes afraid of being thought of as racist for anything. Maybe because they do have racism, but they're trying to keep down, or maybe because they know they're racist, or for whatever reason. But these are conversations that need to happen more often and don't. But there's something even bigger than that, which is that I think fundamentally the problem with race in this country was caused by white people. Whether you're talking about the authorities using racism to split the lower class, or whether you're talking about white people being racist and so on and so forth in various ways. And so that I'm convinced by the idea, at least right now, that the real work that needs to be done is white people upon other white people. Such as the blogger, I forget who he or she was, who said, you know, dear white allies, stop unfriending your friends on Facebook over Ferguson, because it's like, you know, I, as a black person, I'm too angry to breathe right now. You need to do this work. You need to engage them in these difficult conversations that I can't stomach right now. And that really resonated for me. It's like, oh, you don't like getting into a fight on Facebook or even a principled debate? Try being afraid to walk out on the street.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Ferguson, like, yeah, I am much more upset about, like, the Eric Garner and the Tamir Rice situations. The Ferguson, it was, you know, there was some unknowns going on there. But since the testimonies have come out, since the evidence has come out from the trial, it appears that, you know, I mean, natural consequences here is the first thing I thought. You try to take away a police officer's gun in a violent manner, there's a good chance you're going to get shot. And one or both of you is going to end up dead. And that's what happened. I mean, there was some escalation that happened, you know, that maybe some point before that point, things could have gotten calmed down more than it should have been. But I mean, you try to take a police officer's gun, natural consequences, you'll probably get shot or you'll end up being a cop killer.
But there's things that for whether you're liberal or white, I mean, or black, excuse me, whether you're black or liberal or whatnot, there are things in that grand jury testimony that just don't look good to us. Like the fact that, you know, the police officer, you know, said he looked like a demon or called him it or a thing. These are the things that tell us that racism was involved.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also more to it than that, which is, maybe when we liberals look at the way conservatives react to these incidents, we see, maybe I'm wrong about us, but I feel like maybe we see conservatives experiencing the whole thing incident by incident, whereas we liberals see ourselves as experiencing every outburst, every incident, every tragedy as a symptom of a much greater disease, which is that...
I think I can see that, yeah.
I think that's really true for us, is that we see it as a symptom. Michelle Alexander, I've spoken about her before on this podcast. She was saying that, you know, the proper reaction to Eric Garner, Tamir Rice, Ferguson, all of these situations isn't to say the system is broken, but actually to say that the system works. In other words, is producing the results it was intended to produce. Very smart person I know who has nothing to do with Eric Garner or Tamir Rice, who was a very smart social worker, but I won't name him because I didn't ask him. But he said, every system is perfectly designed to produce exactly the result it's producing. Of course, the intention at the outset may be different, but whatever it's doing, it seems to have been designed perfectly to do that thing. So the fact that so a quarter...
In my mind, what the system is doing is, in general, it is producing the result of, I mean, like, such as the police officer. Police officers and, like, the people that are, like, a number of police officers that are killed and the number of people that kill police officers. The people that are killed by police officers and the people that kill police officers are in approximately equal proportion in racially. So there's between like 94 and 2005, 40% of all cop killers were black, and 44% of all, well, actually it's like 30% of all like police homicides were black. And so it's, to me, those numbers, if the biggest disparity should be if there is an epidemic, as you will, of like cops that are biased or gunning down blacks in the street, there would be a disproportionate amount of violence towards the police officers in either side. I mean, it should be approximately proportionate to the amount of crime that's going on. Do you see what I'm saying?
Perhaps, but I think we miss a larger point, which is that, to me, it's a reasonable person statement, just as the sky is blue, that America is a country that if you don't say it's a racist nation, you can at least say it has a disease, and the disease is racism. And that disease has many symptoms.
Well, I think at least that's been in remission for about 40 years.
You know, I don't think so. I think that it's manifested itself in different ways. I was reading an interview with Chris Rock a couple of nights ago, and he was saying, people say, oh, well, black people have made progress. Well, it's not black people who needed to make progress, it's white people. And he says, I'm optimistic for my children because the white people that are being born right now are the nicest white people that have ever been. Like, you know, white people used to be completely crazy, now they're a bit less crazy. That's how he views it, apparently. He was
let me throw some numbers out here. Approximately, in the U.S., between 1882 and 1968, there were 3,446 confirmed black lynchings in the U.S. If you look at abortion statistics, there are 1,784 on average African American children aborted each day. No, so my point is, you know, the people talk about like Black Lives Matter. They talk about all these things that there's black people getting gunned down in the streets, that there's, you know, so much animus that's against them. On any front, looking at abortion, looking at the people that are actually murdered, it's a lot of that has to do with internal things such as poverty, statistic on the urban black children. Not living in a two-parent home. I did find, so 82% of black children in poverty don't live in a two-parent home. So that's the things that I'm finding is it's much more of a class issue and of a lot of decisions that are going on, not necessarily because white people hate black people secretly inside them or openly.
I don't think that white people are secretly hating black people and skewing the system to produce these results. I think that there are laws that have been made that, regardless of the explicit intention, have effectively racist results. Property redlining by banks that make sure that blacks aren't able to move into or weren't able to move into prosperous neighborhoods, restrictive covenants, we could go on. The fact that a quarter of all black men are in prison in the U.S. right now. That's pretty scary. I mean, let me ask you.
So, what you're looking at is
America has a problem with racism?
Systemic? No.
And see, to a liberal, that's like you saying the sky is purple. It's like, well, clearly we do. Look at these numbers and look at how afraid black people are of police officers.
Well, part of that has to do with the fact that, you know, one, the people are afraid of police officers in general that are in a, you know, that are in a place where there's, you know, rampant crime. There's a lot of animus against police officers, whether when you're in poverty-stricken, crime-ridden areas, whether you're black or you're white. And so, I mean, it's, again, I don't think this is a class, I think this is a class thing, not a race thing. And so, to me, we need to look at, you know, what we can do to help people get out of poverty, what we can do to help get the system turned around so it doesn't, leave people in squalor. And, to me, one of the best ways to do that is through, I believe it was Benjamin Franklin, is the best way to help the poor is to make them uncomfortable in their poverty. That doesn't mean that, people shouldn't have food or things like that, but to make it so that wanting to support yourself and like turning our system around so it doesn't encourage people to have children out of wedlock and to not live in the home that's so that it encourages more two-parent households and things of that nature. So I mean that's the kind of thing that I think we need to be their focus on, not on are there a bunch of white cops that want to go around and find a black person to kill, or see a black person and say, hey, that person looks like they're somebody who would be committing a crime. I don't think that's necessarily the issues that we need to, the most pressing issues.
It's all a piece. It's all a holistic whole of racism. And by the way, I'm being relaxed, but the statements you've been making in the last 2 to 3 minutes would be enough to make a lot of liberals' heads explode, such as, oh, we need to make people uncomfortable in their poverty. My experience of
that's a quote from Benjamin Franklin. So,
oh, I know, but you said it approvingly, didn't you? Right. So,
I do approve of the statement. Yes. Uh-huh.
Right. I think the goal shouldn't be to create discomfort. The goal should be to give people a stable foundation from which to not be on welfare.
That's what I'm referring to, is that our current situation discourages people from getting off of welfare and encourages people from staying in the system. It makes it almost impossible to get out of the system even if you want to. And so, I mean, that's the, when a typical family of four, if they get all of the welfare benefits that could be supplied to a typical family of four that has no income, and then to go from, to get off of that system when you have to immediately start making $50,000 in order to have any increase in total benefit to yourself. I mean, that right there is an issue. So, I mean, and also when I say I'm making people uncomfortable in their poverty, I'm not saying like, hey, let's start shooting people in the leg every time they get welfare. It's, nothing on that kind of level. What I'm saying is it needs to be a place that encourages people to move up, to start somewhere and to keep going up, as opposed to a system that constantly is pulling you back into staying on the system, And so I had a question for you, Dan.
Mm-hmm.
So my question for you is, what would it take for you to think that racism was no longer an issue in America?
I would want to see people incarcerated relatively proportional to their status in the population, but certainly not a quarter of all black men incarcerated. But more than that, I would like to see, a wealthy class. I'm being clumsy. Let me start over. If you look at rich America, it's almost all white America as well. Actually, I saw an interesting composite image of, if you take all these, I think it's like Fortune 500 CEOs and average out their faces, you actually get a middle-aged white male.
Mm-hmm.
And that, to me, says we have a problem. That, I classify myself as a reluctant capitalist, meaning I think it's the very best system for creating wealth and high standard of living that's ever existed in the history of the world, but is innately psychopathic and needs to be restrained or it will cause devastation. So, if we are going to be securing the promises of capitalism, that means that I should be seeing just as many prosperous people of all races as white. I should see a country in which we really do get by on the content of our character. I mean, as MLK said, not on the color of our skin. And in which it really is true that if you simply try hard enough, coming from this, everyone will have the same opportunity. And how hard people try, that's not equal, but you have the same opportunity. And I think it's just patently obvious that not everyone in this country does have the same opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what a non-racist nation would look like, in part because this country is, in my vision, so infected with it to the core that it might not look anything like the country I know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my gosh, the Constitution has the 3/5 compromise built in. which I know you know what that is, but just if in case anyone needs the history review, the Three-Fifths Compromise basically meant that the South wanted to have its cake and eat it too. They wanted their slaves to count as population for the purpose of their representation numbers in the House of Representatives, but not to be able to vote. And the North didn't like that very much, so they settled on the Three-Fifths Compromise, so every slave counted as three-fifths of a person for representational purposes. So this country started off with that. Oh, and also, as Barack Obama put it in one of his best speeches, the original sin of slavery.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. I don't think I could possibly be convinced that America is not a racist nation. I think that this country was built on the backs of black people. Black people built the White House, built the Capitol building. Literally, slaves built the White House and built the Capitol building.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are facts, but they are also metaphors.
Yeah.
And the rise of the industrial North pre-Civil War was possible because of the insane profits that you get if you pick cotton with slavery.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not, I'm not saying that there has not been racism in America. I mean, there definitely has been. And there still is racism in America. What I'm saying is that it's not nearly the problem it was. And I think in order to move forward, we need to stop focusing on it so much and start to look at other things. Stop focusing on race so much. It's kind of my thought here. Quick fact check. What I'm getting is if you just look at just African American males between 25 and 29, it's only 10.4% of the male population.
Well, that's because of things like Life Without Parole, where if you take in the whole African-American male population, your numbers will get where about I'm told that they are.
It's about 3% of all black males, according to University of Mass Education. It's about 3% of all African-American males.
I'll have to fact-check later for the next podcast. But,
I was doing a quick look because I'm like, that 25% sounds a bit high to me.
I'll say this in a civil way, but to a white liberal, when a white conservative says we need to stop focusing on race and look at other things, mm-hmm. that to liberal America shows us that white conservative America is completely out of touch with the obvious reality and that we aren't living even in the same universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of that is that in a way conservatives are maybe, there's something to conservatives that maybe you folks are deep down more optimistic about America than we are. I think we're almost more inclined to see how much more broken America is relative to the country's founding ideals. And I think maybe you guys are more optimistic, more sanguine somehow.
A big part of it is that liberals are often so much more future focused than conservatives. Conservatives often live in the now and in the past, whereas liberals often are, I don't know, more starry eyed, I guess, in that they often see, what things should be and try to compare it to that, as opposed to let's look at how things have been and look at where we are now and see the progress that we've come through and try to continue that progress as opposed
sure.
to. Oh no, we've fallen short of our ideals and now we're terrible. I think is the different perspective that's going on here. Like the typical conservative, when they say, look how racist we are, we look at, okay, well, how are we doing in comparison to, the other countries we hear about in the news and to the racism of the past? Like,
right. Neil deGrasse Tyson did say something very similar on Twitter, or I think it was on Twitter that he said it, but he made the point that, yes, this is all very outrageous and sad, but when I was young, this would have been local news, and now it's an international outrage. And when I was feeling very depressed, that made me feel slightly better because it was true. And if memory serves, in 1915, it became illegal to mail a human ear through the U.S. Postal Service, souvenirs of lynchings. And, of course, a law is typically made because there's a perceived need for it. And I thought, wow, you wouldn't do that. I mean, nowadays, on the rare occasion somebody gets distinctly lynched, it's a very big deal.
Yes, and I would agree. Yes. I mean,
so we're way better.
The same kind of thing about rape and a lot of these other things is that those numbers have gone down and we're doing better, And so getting so hard on ourselves every time, we fall slightly short of the highest ideals that have ever been set. Should we try to reach for those ideals? Yes. Should we, flog ourselves every time we fall short of those ideals? No. We learn from it and move on. Is kind of how I would view, like, and I think a lot of the conservatives view the future, like how we should deal with the future.
You know, I guess it's fair to call me starry-eyed, because to me it's like, oh, you know, this was really bad and this was sort of a problem, but we should move on, is to me, you know, this is not fact-driven, this is emotion-driven. I'll be very open about that, but it's like, yeah, try saying that to the mother of Tamir Rice. She's not going to have her son around for Christmas, because if you watch the video, the car drove up and shot the kid, like a drive-by shooting.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not like the Shel Silverstein poem about the cranky woman who said, almost perfect, but not quite. It's more like, mm-hmm. we used to be barbarians, and we're at what we are, whatever that is, it's not nearly good enough. It's not remotely good enough.
And I would say that I would agree with you on that. And I think part of where the distinction is that, you know, again, we see things so much more on an individual level. Was the cop racist that shot Tamir Rice?
And you know, it's interesting.
Do we have evidence of that? Like, it's, you know, or was the cop that shot, that killed Eric Garner racist? Was that, like, that's the kind of thing that we see is like, did he have a racial animus?
Right. And I've certainly seen that discourse, the push and the pull. Was Timothy Loyman, I think that's how you pronounce his name, the cop who shot Tamir Rice, racist? My answer is, I have no idea. I've seen no evidence that he's racist. What I have seen, I don't know if you've seen the mini scandal corollary to the main scandal about how the Cleveland police hired him and they neglected to read the personnel file from the previous police force. Did you see about that?
I think I might have saw something about that.
Okay, so this is important to mention. The Cleveland police force was not his first police job. He used to work for the police in Independence, Ohio, and they were about to fire him, but he resigned for personal reasons, he said. And what was basically happening was that the deputy chief of police, if I recall, that's basically the title, something like that, received a report that this individual had broken down emotionally during firearms training, that he could not handle a firearm properly, that he wept, and that he was not a stable enough individual to serve as a police officer in Independence. And crucially, the letter opined that there was no training that could remedy this deficiency, that he needed to be off the force. And Cleveland police had the opportunity to read that personnel file, but in the wake of this incident, they've had to admit that they did not read it. And Independence is kind of a little podunk.
Yeah.
So I have no idea if he was racist, but I could believe any day that he was an emotionally unstable live wire who finally made someone pay for the fact that he had these flaws.
Yeah, and so that's the kind of thing that, you know, the thing that I think a lot of conservatives would want to do. Okay, this was an issue. Let's fix that issue. Kind of going on a, you know, issue by issue basis. Okay, this person was emotionally unstable and should not have been a police officer. And at least given the evidence that I've seen, that's probably true. We need to fix that so that we don't have emotionally unstable officers that are liable to, you know, go and shoot somebody when they're, you know, or to miss when they're under fire. Like, we should have, our police officers should be stalwart, great people. You know, and if they're not, then they need to be, you know, they need to be off the force.
Right. But here's the thing. Let me give you the flip side. I have no idea if Timothy Loyman was racist. I'm less interested in that. But look at lynchings in the South. In the, you know, the pre-civil rights South, look at lynchings. And
3,500
of them. Oh, and I also meant to add,
African-Americans.
Those are just the ones that we know about. It's sort of like rape statistics. Most rapes never get reported, and most lynchings never got reported either. So I view the number of known incidents as not necessarily even remotely representative of the actual number of these brutalities. We really don't know. That's what I know as a historian is, of course, most lynchings weren't reported. And, you know, plenty of places the Ku Klux Klan owned the whole regional power structure. They were not going to report a lynching. So the numbers to me are a historical artifact and almost certainly drastically underreported and not reliable as historical record. That's what I would say about that. Anyway, when you look at a lynching, you don't see it as an individual problem. It is that, but it's something much more, which is what kind of poison was in the society that a whole bunch of people got around together and did this. maybe for no reason even that they knew of at all, maybe because the black man had allegedly looked at a white woman in a flirtatious manner, he broke the social code. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't, but something. So what's the poison that motivates a whole town to turn out like this and do that? And we really don't, we almost don't have lynchings in America anymore. There's that at least. Thank God. There's that at least. But when you look at an incident that may or may not have been racist on a human, individual level, you still look at what poisons the system against a person. You still look at what's got to be in the atmosphere for anything to happen. What's got to be in the atmosphere that I go to work in the morning,
And so, like, these, you know, mob killings and things of that nature are down. I think part of that is because we've become more prosperous as a nation. And so, you know, when you become more prosperous as a nation, when you're not worried so much about, you know, what am I going to eat the next day? What am I going to, you know, you start worrying about more of the, you know, more of the other issues that are happening. And so I think a lot of the people saw it as, you know, one, it was systemic, enforced by the government. And so it was a, you know, in the racist South, that was a systemic issue that caused number of immoral deaths that should not have occurred, and a lot of people to not have to face the judge, not have to face the natural consequences of killing an innocent person. And so I think a lot of, you know, like that animus, that hatred, that separation, where it's, I can't stand to be around a black person, that is mostly gone. And if it is still there, it's in the shadows. And so I think that is, that kind of racism, I think, is when, say, you know, somebody accuses somebody of racism in, you know, on the news or on, you know, Twitter or something like that. I think when that's the kind of racism that most people see in the past and think, I don't have that, so I'm not racist. And so you see that that's when people say racism is an issue. I think that's why conservatives think, no, it's not. We don't have these issues as we did in the past. Are there giant lynchings? No. Do, like, whole towns get out and, like, beat up a black person for looking at a white person? I mean, like, Emmett Till. As far as I know, there hasn't been an Emmett Till since Emmett Till, in large part because they exposed those hatreds and people realized that it was ugly and they turned around and fled from it because they're like, this is not what we want in our souls to be.
Well, it wasn't immediately so quick as that, Matt. It really wasn't. Emmett Till was lynched in 1957, and the Civil Rights Act wasn't passed until 1964, just the one of them.
I'm not saying it was an immediate process. I'm not saying, like, oh, Emmett Till and everybody turn around. I think it's, you know, rooting out racism does take time. It takes generations. But I think that hatred and that, you know, that old, you know, I think that we have left are, you know, kind of the bones of that racism. And so, you know, in the 1960s, especially in the South, most blacks were in poverty because the system was against them. Now, I don't think the system is, at least in, is not as against them as nearly as it was. And so in order for that to flesh out, it's going to take some time to flesh out for the, you know, it's going to take people looking at themselves, both white, black, you know, whoever, looking at themselves and saying, do I like where I'm at? And how can I improve that, you know, both systemically and as an individual? And that over generations, I think, will eliminate the recesses of the evils of the past.
Could be. My inclination is still to think, and I'm annoyed at myself for not coming in here armed with research and numbers, because I pretty much came home from work, ate dinner, and started recording with you. And so I'm feeling very bereft of a good argument, which is really driving me nuts. But I'll just
I have some more numbers here. What numbers would you like to look at?
Oh, gosh, I need to read multiple books. Numbers aren't good enough. Sorry. I'm feeling that I am not doing a good job at all of advocating the liberal argument that society itself is deeply diseased with racism, regardless of whether individuals carrying out an individual incident are, in fact, quote-unquote, racist.
Well, in my mind, it's the system is made up of each individual instance. And so if there are no more instances that are, in fact, racist, then racism isn't a problem anymore.
Well, that and plus if the system no longer produced racially biased results, regardless of who is implementing them.
So, I mean, it's kind of interesting. Like, when you look at, like, racial bias, I think you look at, like, the hard line numbers of, okay, so, how many black people are there? How many black people are in prison? There's a disparity. So there's a, there's a systemic racism that's going on. It could do it. Am I reading you right on that?
I believe I'm basically just arguing that society is deeply diseased with racism. I'm trying to, if I seem a bit distracted, I'm pulling out a book of mine
Okay.
to see if I can find anything good to pull out here.
So, to me, a lot of things have to do more with choices and the things the choices that people make. And so, for instance, by assuming that the reason that there are, a large number of, nonviolent or violent criminals in prison, like the war on drugs, is that it's racist against black people, the war on drugs. That to me, it's anyway, I think I'm a lot, my train just derailed.
Well, here's an interesting thing. You're speaking of the war on drugs, reading from Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow. Studies show that people of all colors use and sell illegal drugs at remarkably similar rates. If there are significant differences in the surveys to be found, they frequently suggest that whites, particularly white youth, are more likely to engage in drug crime than people of color. That is not what one would guess, however, when entering our nation's prisons and jails, which are overflowing with black and brown drug offenders. In some states, black men have been admitted to prison on drug charges at rates 20 to 50 times greater than those of white men. And in major cities racked by the drug war, as many as 80% of young American men, excuse me, African American men now have criminal records and are thus subject to legalized discrimination for the rest of their lives. These young men are part of a growing undercast, permanently locked up and locked out of mainstream society. So that's part of a much larger book. But those kinds of arguments are where we liberals are coming from when we say the whole system is designed to produce racist results.
So 80% of African Americans, and I would like to see where they're getting these numbers from. Is everything
Okay, well, let's
I've
see.
been looking at
Actually,
some of these
I'm about to
imprisonment
click on,
numbers.
I know, I'm actually clicking on the list. There she's specifically linking to a book called The Vicious Circle: Race, Prison, Jobs, and Community in Chicago, Illinois, and the Nation, which was published by Paul Street in 2002. So that's that reference. Haven't read that
Okay.
book. She didn't just pull that out. There was a footnote. Or rather, it's been too long since I was in college. Oh, that's annoying. An end note. But in any case.
I'm seeing an interesting trend here, and I'm wondering, like, I'm looking at the number of people incarcerated in America by millions, and it looks like there's a sharp increase right around just past 1980, between 1980 and 1990. And
The tough on crime movement and all these sorts of things.
I wonder if that has something to do with why murders are down.
Well, that's correlation, not causation.
It's correlation. I'm not saying that this is, like there could be a bajillion things that are causing this, and no one's 100% certain as to what are the causes and what are just correlations. But there is a distinct correlation between like the amount of like murders and things, and inverse relationship between like the amount of incarcerated Americans and like things like such as murder rate.
Now, are you also familiar with discriminatory sentencing around drugs?
I've heard a little bit about it.
Okay, so what it basically means is that in a lot of jurisdictions, actually, I can just. So basically, white people tend, or at least in the past, tended to use cocaine, powder cocaine, and black people tended to use crack cocaine, and you would go for far more prison time for possession of the same amount of crack cocaine versus powder cocaine. I
Which
read
is
a conviction
ridiculous.
for the. Right, a conviction for the sale of 500 grams of powder cocaine triggers a 5-year mandatory sentence. Well, only 5 grams of crack triggers the same sentence. So, for example, this just goes to highlight the point of the California Three Strikes Law. You don't have to have a racist judge. You just have to have a judge who's following the mandatory guidelines because they have to, because mandatory. So is the judge racist? Not necessarily. Are the rules racist? Yes. Effectively, yes.
So we need to change those rules.
Right,
And
so it's
that's,
an example of the fact that from a liberal perspective, the whole system is poisoned with racism, because even if individuals aren't racist, the system reliably produces racist results across the board, ensuring that an underclass will remain, whether under the control of poverty, under the control of the penal system, under the control of police who are far too quick to pull their guns, all of that at the same time.
Mm-hmm. You know, if there are racist rules, get rid of them. Change them. Do it. If there are things that are detrimentally affecting the black population or Hispanic population or the white population, whatever, they need to be changed. And, you know, justice should be as blind as possible as we can possibly make it. You know, like, that's the whole, like, the blind justice. Like, that's what justice should be. Should be colorblind, should be gender blind, should be blind to all these things. If you commit a crime, you should be going to prison for, you know, if someone else commits that exact same crime, you should be going to prison the same amount of time as that person. You know, if the exact same circumstances should be the exact same thing. I mean, so, you know, crack versus powder cocaine, they do the same thing, then it should be the same kind of sentencing.
And you know,
if there are those rules, then get rid of them.
I'm also going to go through Michelle Alexander talking about racial profiling. Mm-hmm. In Volusia County, Florida, a reporter obtained 148 hours of video footage documenting more than 1,000 highway stops conducted by state troopers. Only 5% mm-hmm. of the drivers on the road were African American or Latino, but more than 80% of the people stopped and searched were minorities. In Illinois, the state mm-hmm. police initiated a drug interdiction program known as Operation Valkyrie that targeted Latino motorists. While Latinos compromised less than 8% of the Illinois population and took fewer than 3% of the personal vehicle trips in Illinois, they compromised approximately 30% of the motorists stopped by drug interdiction officers for discretionary offenses, such as failure to signal a lane change. Latinos, however, mm-hmm. were significantly less likely than whites to have illegal contraband in their vehicles. And finally, a racial profiling study in Oakland, California in 2001 showed that African Americans were approximately twice as likely as whites to be stopped and three times as likely to be searched. So those are just a few examples of how we as liberals feel the system is diseased with racism, and therefore we are mm-hmm. a racist nation because our system is racist.
If there are those instances, then get rid of them. I mean, that's why there should be people that are looking into these things and finding them out and looking at them and saying, okay, look, guys, this is what's going on. This is why it needs to change. I agree with that. So if there are racist laws, if there are those things, then they need to change.
So you asked me what it would take for me to think it wasn't a racist nation. What would it take for you to think it was?
That it wasn't a racist nation?
That it is, yes.
That it is a racist nation?
Or, let me be honest, from the liberal perspective, Matt, what would it take for you to realize that it's a racist nation? I mean, I realize that's a loaded question, but that's how a liberal would come at you, mm-hmm. if I'm just open with that.
I would need proof that there is a racial animus amongst people against a certain group.
But what if the racism is expressed by the system's rules rather than felt in the hearts of the people entirely? What if there was some of each? For example,
well, if there's some of each, then we would have, then we you would still have racism, you know. So I mean, there's, you know, to me, like, I think a big part of this is what we're defining as racism, because to me, when I look at racism, I look at hardline racism, people like conscious racism. Is there subconscious racism? Sure.
I see. And so that's, I think, is what it's.
America is no longer a conscious racist, is what I'm saying. You know, when I say race, it's not a racist nation. It's not a consciously racist nation anymore. Are there possibly things that, you know, are disproportionately affected, or, you know, caused by an individual who happens to be racist, or somebody who has an idea which turns out to disproportionately affect? That would be subconscious racism. So is there subconscious racism in America? Yes. If you're looking at just subconscious, then yes, it is.
I think I'm getting you now. You're saying that from a conservative perspective, racism means is there a consciously felt animus against people of another race in a person?
Uh-huh, yeah. So when you say racism, that's what conservatives think. And so they're like, well, I'm not racist. Actually, the system's not racist. And so that's, I think, part of, I think we've struck a chord here as to what's going on here, is that there isn't, you know, there's very little conscious racism left in America.
And if there is, people know that they're not allowed to express it. Unlike in the 19... Huh?
Exactly.
Exactly. We know that we're not allowed to say certain words that we should never say, but basically a white person knows that if he or she utters the N-word, your career is over. Whatever you had is over right now. your wife's going to divorce you, whatever, it's over. Mm-hmm. And that's all as it should be, I suppose. Yes, it is. I don't just suppose, I think. But the point being, that means that we don't get to find out about people's consciously felt racism as much as we used to, because they're more careful than they used to be, not necessarily because they are, in fact, better than they used to be.
Mm-hmm.
And so to liberals, it's not just about consciously felt racism, consciously expressed animus. It's that, but it's also about the construction of a system itself that reliably produces unjust results.
Mm-hmm. And so in that circumstance, I would agree. Are there some unjust results and things going on here? Yes. You know, the Eric Garner case. Should Eric Garner have been killed for selling Lucy cigarettes? And, you know, was he not resisting arrest? No. You know, they should be aware of, like, what the fact that if you put a 350-pound person on their stomach, they're likely to not be able to breathe.
And I'll read something else here. This is going to take a couple of minutes, but it's worth sort of getting into the record, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Talking, of course, about the shooting of Amadou Diallo at the age of 22 at the hands of New York cops, who, by the way, fired 41 shots. He was pulling his wallet out of his pocket. They thought it was a gun, and they killed him instantly. So Michelle Alexander writes, rather than reducing reliance on stop-and-frisk tactics following the Diallo shooting and the release of this disturbing data, the NYPD dramatically increased its number of pedestrian stops and continued to stop and frisk African Americans at grossly disproportionate rates. The NYPD stopped 5 times more people in 2005 than in 2002, the overwhelming majority of whom were African American or Latino. By 2008, the NYPD was stopping 545,000 people in a single year, and 80% of the people stopped were African Americans and Latinos. Whites comprised a mere 8% of people frisked by the NYPD, while African Americans accounted for 85% of all frisks. A report by the New York Times found that the highest concentration of stops in the city was a roughly 8-block area of Brownsville, Brooklyn, that was predominantly black. Residents there were stopped at a rate 13 times the city average. And I'll just continue on for a little bit more. Although the NYPD frequently attempts to justify stop-and-frisk operations in poor communities of color on the grounds that such tactics are necessary to get guns off the streets, less than 1% of stops, specifically 0.15%, resulted in guns being found, and guns and other contraband were seized less often in stops of African Americans and Latinos than of whites. As Darius Charney, a lawyer for the Center for Constitutional Rights, observed, these studies, quote, confirm what we have been saying for the last 10 or 11 years, which is that with stop-and-frisk patterns, it is really race, not crime, that is driving this, unquote. Ultimately, these stop-and-frisk operations amount to much more than humiliating, demeaning rituals for young men of color who must raise their arms and spread their legs, always careful not to make a sudden movement or gesture that could provide an excuse for brutal, even lethal force, like the days when black men were expected to step off the sidewalk and cast their eyes downward when a white woman passed. Young black men know the drill when they see the police crossing the street toward them. It is a ritual of dominance and submission played out hundreds of thousands of times each year. But it is more than that. These routine encounters often serve as the gateway into the criminal justice system. The NYPD made 50,300 marijuana arrests in 2010 alone, mostly of young men of color. As one report noted, these marijuana arrests offer, quote, training opportunities, unquote, for rookie police who can practice on ghetto kids while earning overtime. Anyhow, I don't want to just continue reading aloud. But
yeah, I mean, so in those, I personally, like, to me, that's a Fourth Amendment violation. Like, the stop and frisk program is a Fourth Amendment violation. It needs to stop.
Right. And we're on the same page with that. And I thought you would be. I thought you would be. But a lot of conservatives are actually very much for that around New York City.
Mm-hmm. I think part of that also has to do with a lot of anti-gun sentiment, which, you know, I do not have and do not think that people, you know, should have. It's, if you want to carry a gun for personal protection, you should be allowed to do it unless you're an active criminal. You know, which you can't really do in New York City. You can't do it in Washington, D.C. or Chicago. And that's what they're supposedly looking for. But it leads to, you know, again, like that whole dominance thing. It's like, you know, you're putting someone else in their place. You know, it's a person should feel secure in their person, in what they're doing, unless they do something that is, to me, if you're going to stop and frisk somebody, they need to be like shooting at you or like have a gun pointed at you, or, you know, like are like going to run you down in their car or something. I mean, you know, like there needs to be an immediate danger in order for you to search someone without a warrant.
So the thing is that all of these examples I've been bringing up, they aren't just examples, they're symptoms of the disease. And where liberals get gobsmacked is that conservatives, even if they do agree that these things are happening, don't see them as symptoms of a disease. They just see them as isolated instances, whereas to me it's obvious that this is a part of a diseased system that needs to be overhauled.
And I agree. And the way that I think that it should be fixed is that we have too big of a government. We need to get the government out of people's lives more.
You mean like... I'm feeling mischievous here, and I'm going to totally bomb this conversation, and I'm so sorry, but you mean like getting rid of all these cumbersome abortion legislation bits? Because that's not just in people's lives, but forgive me, that's in the vagina. I mean, stay away! It's not for you! It's for her and her doctor! So we liberals say, yes, government should be smaller and stay out of people's lives, and out of their vaginas too. You know, we all see that as a piece too. When we look at conservatives, and I'm so sorry, but we see a logical hole, and I hope I don't make this into an abortion war piece because we've done that anyway, and I don't need to detract, but I gone and done it, you know.
Well, I've brought up abortion too, so, you know, fair enough. To me, I don't like abortion. You know, I don't think women should be having abortions in general. I mean, it's, you know, I believe that the life of the infant is worth more than a few months of discomfort and pain. I, honestly, that's my position, is that the life of that child is worth a few months of you know, again, of going through pregnancy. My wife has been, we're almost at the end of our third pregnancy. It sucks sometimes, I know, but to me that life, that child, and so that's kind of the, you know, that's where I'm coming from, is that life, you know. And so if this is an invasion of privacy, there's a few laws that are about, you know, getting an ultrasound, or like hearing the baby's heartbeat before you have the abortion, if it's that far along. Is that the best way to counteract abortion? I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe there are better ways of doing it. Maybe we should, you know, make contraceptives over the counter. Maybe we need to get the government less out of things, and it would make things better rather than worse. I don't know for sure, but to me, like, you know, I think our common ground was that abortions should be safe, legal, and rare, and that we should work on, I think our common ground was that they should be, you know, I think at least rare. And so what we can do to make safe, them rare, legal, I don't know. Rare.
I mean, I think it's a tragedy to have to end any life. I just think it needs to be safe, legal, and rare. And rare not because it's legislatively made impossible or nearly impossible to get one, but rare because it's not needed.
Yeah, I mean, when it's more likely that that there are more black babies aborted in New York City than are born in New York City, that's terrible. I mean, it's what we need, what we can do. Do we need to encourage more adoption? Do we need to, you know, have more fathers in home? Do we need to have, you know, there's a lot of things that could potentially help these things.
It's interesting you talk about, we're talking about racism this episode. Years ago, I was at a fascinating discussion about race and adoption and how hard it makes the thing. And this is just one of those times when you realize how racist our country really is. Because a black family adopting a black child, I don't know the numbers on that, but it turns out that black babies from the United States are often adopted by families in Northern Europe, in the Netherlands and such, because they are wanted and loved, and white families in the U.S. don't seem to want to adopt these babies. So what's driving that? You always have to wonder.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I think part of adoption is that, one, people have compassion for people, and another big part of what adoption is it's a way out for people that are unable to have their own children, or want, you know, at any stage, whether it's they're too old, whether they've had, you know, a number of different reasons for that. But, and so a mother, like, I think, you know, I think a lot of the motherly instinct is that deep down, I'm trying to to think, like, it's the same reason that people tend to buy dolls of the same color as their person, as their daughter, for their daughter, because they want to look like their, you know, they want their children to look like them. And, you know, we're all people. We do look like each other. You know, we're not, you know, and so I think part of that is that we still see black people as different, you know, like that there's as different from us. We see that color as, you know, a glaring thing. And so I think that's one of the subconscious things that needs to be overcome. But, you know, then we have things like Mitt Romney's son adopted a black child, and then they go and make fun of him on MSNBC for it, you know. And so that's the kind of thing that needs to be overcome in order for at least part of that adoption thing to be, is, you know. And I mean, my wife's boss, they adopted, they're in the process of adopting a couple of little black boys. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. you know, and it's a wonderful thing. Adoption is wonderful. And I think there's a lot to overcome. There's a lot of compassion that needs to be refound and rekindled. And a lot of the hatred is not going to be overcome. Hatred can't be overcome by more hatred. It can only be overcome by more love.
Yep. Yep. And
so we need to show an increase of love, and that's what's going to ultimately, I think, solve the racial issues, the, you know, a lot of the discrimination, the other, you know, terrible, like, on other things, is that we all subconsciously want to find something to despise or to hate, whether it's, you know, the rival sports team, to, you know, to the another race, to a certain other people, to people of a different religion. And we need to overcome that in order for all of these subconscious things to melt away. Is we need to show forth love and overcome that with love.
Yeah, but we also need to have channeled, intelligent, well-aimed outrage at all the things that are wrong, especially systemically. We need to...
I would refer to it as righteous indignation, but yes.
Righteous indignation, yes. We need to overhaul the criminal justice system so that it actually produces justice.
Mm-hmm. Yep, there should be blind justice. And if there are instances or systemic-wide ways that is, we need to make it more blind, honestly. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably our common ground here.
Yeah.
You know, we need to make justice as blind as possible.
Yep. So, this is Dan Barish, the Jewish liberal from Cleveland, signing off.
And this is Matt Shepard, the Mormon conservative from Seattle, signing off.